It's Elise here, and I'm back with episode 12. This episode is going to be all about Crow's Nest Pass in Alberta. So you know the drill. If you're listening again, thank you so much. And if you're a new listener, welcome. Crow's Nest Pass is the amalgamation of five municipalities: Bellevue, Blairmore, Coleman, Frank, and Hillcrest. The first mine in the area opened in 1900, and communities were created afterward. There is a lot of old histories in these towns, some still inhabited and some are not. I'm excited to share with you the real history of a famous disaster in Alberta, the Frank Slide. I came to realize that there are several misconceptions and mistruths about the disaster, and many that I thought were true until I spoke with someone on the ground, so to speak. I will also be talking about a tragic mine disaster that is believed to have been prefaced by an eerie omen. Finally, I have the really tragic tale of Monty Lewis. So let's get started. The first story that I'm going to talk about is the Frank Slide. If there are Albertans especially listening to this, you're probably familiar with this story. An entire town buried under a rock slide from Turtle Mountain. Perhaps you've also heard that the only survivor was a baby girl pulled from the rubble. Well, what if I told you those two things are not entirely true? Bear with me here. I also believed these statements to be true, but when I connected with Joey at the Frank Slide Interpretive Center, he clarified those things for me and said that due to reporting at the time and miscommunications, there were some things that were put out to the public that just weren't true. I have an article from the Wetaskiwin Times back in 1903 that will be up on the blog. It's pretty evident from the headline that it would have been really easy to get a different impression of the disaster just by reading the headline. The article says, "An awful catastrophe, the town of Frank wiped out of existence." So here's the real story. The story actually begins hundreds of years ago when supposedly, Joey says, the First Nations people had warned European settlers against camping or building beneath Turtle Mountain. They called it an evil mountain. Now, how this may have started is that First Nations groups thousands of years ago in the area used to search for a rock called chert, which is a type of flint. Now, it's hypothesized that they could have made their way to the top of Turtle Mountain, thinking it was a good place to find chert. In making their way to the top, which isn't particularly difficult, they would have seen large cracks. If they came back years later, the cracks would have been noticeably larger, which could be why it was given the nickname the Mountain That Moves. Furthermore, if anyone camped below the mountain in springtime, they would have experienced rocks falling from the mountain from a process called frost wedging. With all of these things, it's not surprising that over the next 1,000 years, information passed down about it being a bad mountain and not to camp there, etc., would have made this original claim of the settlers being warned entirely plausible. And this really becomes also kind of about how legends and stories become just that, a legend. Because as we go through history, something starts out as one thing and it's almost like a game of telephone being played over thousands of years and little details being changed and little things being said differently. And then we come with this, that it's an evil mountain and there's maybe even something supernatural about it. So now let's fast forward to 1901, when the town of Frank was well established and sitting below Turtle Mountain. There was a mine sunk deep into the mountain as there was massive coal deposits below. There's a story about how tremors felt inside of the mountain were common, and miners actually liked them because it made their job a lot easier. How? Because when the mountain would shake, coal would just fall from the ceiling for the miners to simply shovel up and take out. By 1903, this was a warning sign, along with the sounds of cracking and rumbling that the miners had grown used to and ultimately ignored. It was the morning of April 29th, 1903, at 4:10 in the morning, when a mere 100 seconds, less than 2 minutes, 110 million metric tons of limestone fell from the top of Turtle Mountain. The sound was so loud that people from kilometers around and even as far as Calgary, and I'll have a map up so people who don't know offhand how far that is can see, even heard the roar. The slide was traveling approximately 120 kilometers per hour. That's crazy and just so scary to think. I mean, really, you would have no chance of outrunning anything. Now, here comes the first part of our history that gets a little bit misconstrued. Where did it fall? Where is the town now if it didn't bury it? It's widely believed by people that the slide came down and buried the entire town. But the slide actually came down and missed most of the town. 500 people were untouched. An unlucky row of homes to the side of the main town were in the direct path. And tragically, of the approximately 100 people buried in the rubble, only 12 were rescued from the shallower edges, and approximately 90 are still out there. Obviously, there can't be a concrete number, as the bodies have not been recovered and probably never will, as some of the areas are 45 meters deep. Now, when people came back to visit the site years later, and saw that there was no town there, only rubble, this only fueled the belief that the entire town was buried. However, there is another explanation. The town basically picked up and left. Many of the 500 residents that were there during the slide did move away for fear of another slide. However, the town actually grew in the following years, and the town had nowhere to expand to. So it was moved to the new Frank site, northwest of the original town. And again, I will have a map so you can kind of see where the slide came down, where old Frank was, and where new Frank moved to. It's really close. Turtle Mountain was monitored by scientists, and they determined that the mountain was unstable, and the town was, in fact, in danger of another slide. So at this point, all of the buildings in Old Frank were ordered to be moved. So some were moved to New Frank, and others were moved to other areas in Alberta. There were some amazing stories of survival that came out of this disaster, and this is exactly what fueled the other common myth associated with the Frank slide, that a baby girl was the sole survivor. So now we know that there were more survivors than just the one. But there is some miraculous truth rooted in this myth. In the area hit by the slide, there were actually three baby girls who survived it. The first, Fernie Watkins, was 3 years old. She was found in the debris outside of her family home. The next was 27-month-old Marion Leach, who was thrown from her home and found in a pile of hay. That's pretty amazing. The final girl was Gladys Innes, and she was just 15 months old. She was found thrown from her home and choking on thick mud. Her life was saved by her parents, who cleared the mud from her airway. So the papers and word of mouth talked about a miracle baby dubbed Frankie Slide, who was found in the rubble. Some say she was found sitting on top of a lone boulder, and some say that she had been thrown and found in a bale of hay. So now we know the truth. There are some more harrowing stories of survival and near misses for other townspeople, and I'll have those up on the blog if you'd like to know more. There are some paranormal claims to come out of this site. I do want to mention again the stone tape theory. This is widely accepted, and I've spoken about this with Paul Bush from Cornerstone and in many of the episodes. So I'll include some of the links and more information about STT. It's believed that certain materials, and limestone is one of them, are highly conductive to paranormal activity. So with the whole of this massive slab from Turtle Mountain being primarily limestone, there are many that would look at this site and not be surprised at all about activity here. Some of the claims are about shadows and mist-like apparitions. Joey included a note about an archaeologist who found human remains in the slide. He stayed nearby for a night but didn't last long, as an apparition with a pickaxe refused to leave him alone. There are also many reports where people claim to see mist moving unnaturally over the debris field. It's also thought that apparitions of family members of the deceased may be drawn back here to look for their loved ones in death. Along with all of this, many people also claim just to get strange feelings and even feelings of extreme sadness in connection to this location. And honestly, in talking to some other people that I know who are sensitives, and even my friend Brianne, who has come on the show to talk about the unsolved mysteries, and she will be on the next episode. Even she said, you know, you get this really eerie feeling even driving on the highway coming up to it. So it's definitely, I think, a place that's known very well in Alberta and British Columbia for being sort of an eerie place. So I do want to tell a quick story that's often talked about with the Frank Slide, and especially with locals who will remember Big Charlie. Following the slide, there were 17 miners trapped inside, and they actually dug themselves out over the course of 13 hours. A month later, men were sent back into the mine to assess damage and to see if the mine could be reopened. The three men made their way through the blocked entrance and began to hear chains rattling. So, just as I would have, thinking it was a ghost's ominous presence, they ran from the mine. They settled down outside and built up the courage to re-enter. Making their way further in, they found Big Charlie, the mine horse who was still alive after a month. He had been drinking seepage water and snacking on wooden timbers. So he was in really rough shape when they brought him out, and they sent off for some food. And now, in their excitement to reward him and treat him to a feast of brandy and oats, they actually ended up killing him. Poor Charlie. They killed him with kindness, quite literally. Poor Charlie's stomach just wasn't ready for that amount of food. And Joey says that Big Charlie is still regarded as one of the survivors of the Frank Slide. So you can visit this site today. There is an interpretive center, as I mentioned, and I'll link all of the information on the blog and under the map tours tab. There are some amazing exhibits, information, and they even actually have two documentaries that play regularly inside of the center. There's a large boardwalk outside that overlooks the slide site. Now, Joey said if you have the time to come in, please do. And it's not expensive at all. Again, I'll have the admission prices listed. But Joey says he would also like people to know there's no cost just to stand on the boardwalk and look. So that's an option too. If you just want to see the site and you just want to look out, that's absolutely allowed. Lastly, he said that if you do want to know about some of the other Crow's Nest Pass locations of note, and some that I'll be talking about in the new year, go in and chat with them. They're a hub of information for really all places around there. If they know of it and they can help you out by giving you directions or even brochures to help you out, they absolutely will. The next story I'm going to talk about is the tragic Hillcrest mine disaster. This was the worst mine disaster in Canadian history, but interestingly, if you ask people, most have never heard of it. Why? Because just over a week later, World War I broke out and the memory of what happened in this little village was lost. Hillcrest was incorporated in 1905 and named after prospector and entrepreneur Charles Plummer Hill. The town built up around the mine, like so many others in this area, and eventually grew to a bustling 1,000 people. Mines were and are, of course, inherently dangerous, but Hillcrest Mine was actually known as one of the safest in the area. Even still, there was a disaster looming. The morning of June 19, 1914, 235 men went off to work, but sadly only 48 would return home. Shortly after 9 a.m., a pocket of methane gas ignited, and this set off a larger coal dust explosion. Black smoke billowed into the air, and coal cars appeared at the surface with bodies clinging to life and gasping for clean air. Sadly, some who didn't succumb in the mine would later pass from something miners refer to as afterdamp, which is when you breathe in a toxic mixture of gases from the mine fire. The explosion rocked the small town, and quite literally, its effect not only physically felt, but the emotional aftershocks rocked the community and its families for years. Hundreds of children were left without fathers and women left widowed by the tragic blast. The disaster happened on a Friday, which was payday, but the miners' checks were put into a trust fund instead of given to these broken families, and they were left with nothing. They couldn't even feed their children in most cases. Some families did receive money almost a year later, but that didn't help them when they needed it. In the meantime, surrounding townspeople rallied around the families, helping in any way that they could. The majority of the miners were buried in two mass graves in the Hillcrest Cemetery, 112 men buried side by side. There is actually a website that was set up at www.hillcrestminedisaster.com, and I will have a link up on the blog. This was set up as an homage to the miners who lost their lives that fateful day. So it's pretty interesting. You can actually click on the miners' names, and the creators of the site have then put up a blurb with anything that they could find about that miner, about where they were from, or if they had family. So I think it's kind of a really nice thing to do. So if you are interested, please check that out. Now, the paranormal element that I heard from Joey about this location is that back in this time, women being seen at a mine site was seen as an omen of bad luck, which I think is rude. And one story that has remained over the years and was perpetuated by survivors is that a woman in black carrying a candle was seen inside Hillcrest Mine that morning. Who could this woman have been? Why did so many of the miners believe that they did see this woman and that she was the cause of the explosion? This is, along with many of the stories I tell, just another question that will most likely never be answered. The last story that I'm going to get into today is the story of Monty Lewis. Monty Lewis was a very popular lady of the night. She ran a brothel in Frank in 1907. Now, brothels were often staples in these mining towns, and with so many miners and prospectors coming in and out of the town, it was a bustling business. Now, Monty was very successful in her line of work. She was apparently having a new home built near her brothel, and really, for a single woman of that time, that just goes to show she was making really good money. One very well-known thing about Monty is that she had a love of extravagant jewelry and never went anywhere, even to bed, without her jewels. So I'm sure she had many regulars, but one in particular would prove to be very dangerous. His name was Maxim Polipchuk, a Ukrainian immigrant who was working in the mine. So upon coming to Canada, he did anglicize his name to Mike Phillips, and this is how I'll refer to him from now on. But I did want to mention his original name because in newspaper articles, sometimes both names were referenced. So Mike had become pretty well known in Frank as a man with a gambling habit that landed him in some pretty huge debt with many people in town. He was also a frequent patron of Monty Lewis, and the last thing I'll tell you about this man is that he was married. He had married his wife Rosie only a year prior, and they lived on a farm in northern Alberta with her parents. Mike had gone off to work as a miner with the promise that he would send back his wages and they would be able to build a nice life together. Well, the total he had ever sent his wife in 1 year was a whopping $14, which would be about $380 nowadays. This might sound like maybe it wasn't too bad in those days, but in one report, it cited his wages one Friday were $104 or $2,800 today, and he spent almost all of it with Monty and gambling around town within 72 hours. So not great. The evening of November 19th, 1907, and weird side note, as I was writing this episode, it was actually the 112th anniversary, so kind of weird. A constable with the Northwest Mounted Police was looking for a suspect in a crime that had been committed that night. He was checking in at local hotels and brothels and went past Monty Lewis's. The lights were all out and he knocked on the door. He even tried the door, but it was locked. He went on his way and checked out other places nearby, and when he came back past about 2 hours later, the lights were on at Monty's. He noted also that a side door was open, so he went inside and called out for her or anyone, but the home appeared to be empty. That is until he checked out Monty's room and noticed that the quilt on her bed was black with blood. He pulled the quilt back and found the home's owner nude, apart from glittering jewelry and a pair of stockings. She had literally been hacked to death. The scene was exceptionally brutal. Her throat had been slit and her head had been hacked and stabbed. She had been stabbed in the chest and defensive wounds were present on her hands and arms. The constable called for further officers, and upon checking the scene, they found a bloody hatchet and a long carving knife under the kitchen table. The kitchen tools were identified later by her cook, Ma Sing, who confirmed that they were what he would use in the kitchen to prepare meals. One news article from the time did say that the cook was detained for a period of time, which makes sense, but he was soon let go. The police took statements from the cook, another brothel worker named Frankie Harris, two painters who had been working on Monty's house, and other mine workers in the town. And the police would continue to hear the same name from all of these people, Mike Phillips. The cook had stated that Mike Phillips was staying at the home for the past 2 days. Frankie Harris had been one of Monty's girls and was staying with her until 3 days prior to the murder. She also stated that Mike Phillips had been there. She also said that Monty hadn't deposited her $200 that week, as she usually did. So she knew that Monty had it on her person. The local banker also confirmed that she usually did come by and deposit $200 a week, but had not come in that week. Two painters that were working on Monty's new home backed up the cook's story about Mike Phillips being at the home for the past 2 days. Other miners and people from the town placed Mike Phillips specifically at the brothel. So the police believed they had their man. So where was he? Well, they tracked him back to his in-law's farm where he had told them that he had to walk home because he'd been robbed. So he was arrested and put on trial in May of 1908 for the murder of Monty Lewis. The prosecution determined that the motive had been robbery. Monty's jewelry was still around her neck, but that $200 that she was determined to have still been in possession of was missing. Her room was also noted as looking like her drawers had been gone through. Now, Mike Phillips would have had motive to want that money. He had gambling debts to pay and had just blown through his paycheck in 3 days. Of course, the defense attacked the victim and created doubt to the jury that due to her unsavory lifestyle, she would have had many men around her with access. And these other men could have done this to her. Basically, this was the 1908 way of saying she was asking for it. Ugh. Yeah. Mike Phillips still needed something extra to prove that he was a good guy. So his father-in-law, John Orchek, was called in as a character witness, and despite not actually really knowing his son-in-law, he gave him a glowing personal reference. And that was it. The jury was swayed and Mike Phillips was acquitted. Well, this was not the last we would hear of Mike Phillips, and sadly, his father-in-law would very much regret the nice things he would say about the man who would later murder his daughter, Rosie. In March of 1912, an article in the Edmonton Bulletin would cover this crime. In a headline that read, "Alleged murderer still eluding capture." Rosie Phillips had separated from her husband and had remained living at the Packin, Alberta farm with her parents. She had actually thought he was dead until he arrived without notice at her father's farm. Rosie was working at one of the hotels in town when she was sent for. She returned swiftly home, and while getting water from the well, Mike Phillips approached her and asked, "Will you live with me now?" and then shot her 3 times in the chest. She was taken to the hospital and succumbed to her injury within a couple hours. She was aware enough, however, to give details of the crime. So unlike Monty Lewis, there was no doubt that it was Mike. I wish I could say that justice finally came, but Mike Phillips was able to elude capture and was never heard from again. The police put up a $200 reward, which when I plugged into my new favorite resource, showed me that it would be just over $5,000 now. But despite this huge reward, there was nothing. They believed that he was being protected and harbored by fellow Ukrainian immigrants in the area who knew him. The only other article I was able to find was about a year later, and it was saying that police were still unable to locate him. They made it known that if anyone was found out to be helping the fugitive, that authorities would, quote, not deal gently with them. While nothing was ever heard from him again, his first victim, Monty, has been heard from for the last 100 years. Legend has it that Monty Lewis is said to forever wander the old town of Frank, wailing the early and brutal death that befell her. Some believe that shrill echoes that are heard when the wind blows through the valley is actually Monty Lewis. Joey from the Frank Slide Interpretive Center believes that it's just the wind as it rushes through the valley, and maybe it is, but what if it isn't? Two hikers who were on Turtle Mountain in the 80s were trapped. They yelled and yelled, hoping that someone in the valley would hear them. But they would later say, and yes, they were rescued, everything was fine, that their voices were drowned out by wailing coming from the valley below. They certainly believed that it was Monty Lewis. So what do you think? This brings me to the end of the episode. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. I personally really liked this one because I learned a lot. Being from Alberta myself, I really thought I knew everything about my province and for sure about the big things that have happened, like the Frank Slide. So it was really interesting to hear the real facts. So please let me know what you think about the stories this week. Don't forget to check out the blog so you can see the amazing and heartbreaking photos from the Frank Slide and the Hillcrest Mine explosion. I will also have links to that memorial page that I talked about so you can read a little bit more about some of the miners who lost their lives. I will also have the many news articles that I was able to find for the Monty Lewis and Rosie Phillips murders. There's a lot of evidence to back up these stories, so it's very interesting. I will also have all of the information for the Frank Slide Interpretive Center if you do want to pay the site a visit. And I highly recommend it. It's very interesting. Please make sure that you check all of that out on my website at realscarypodcast.ca. You can email me at realscarypodcast@gmail.com. Please make sure to follow me on Facebook and Instagram at realscarypodcast. Also, I would love it if you would hit that subscribe button and that like button on whichever platform you listen on. Please feel free to leave me a comment or rating. You can even put a rating up on Facebook if you'd like. I would love that. I love to hear your comments, and it all just helps me to continue making this show and to make it even better for you, the listener. I was going to do another episode for this season, but the one location I really want to talk about is actually in its off season. So I don't really want to rush this story, and the more eyewitnesses I can speak to, I think the better, and it just makes it better for you guys. So I've made the decision to finish out the season with an Unsolved Mysteries episode. So Brianne will be back with me, and I'll be releasing that episode on December 17th. Same time as always, and same places as always, and that will be the season finale. So I hope you will all stick with me and come back in the new year for season 2. Until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.